Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming's arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we are going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we take a look at what's in store for U.S. Treasuries by the end of 2023.
Plus, can major banks get a boost from a jump in fixed income, currency, and commodities?
But first, global solar demand is poised to soar past 320 gigawatts in 2023. For more, we're joined by Bloomberg Intelligence senior energy analyst Rob Barnett. Rob, this sounds huge. Put it into perspective for us.
Well, it is the fastest growing corner of the energy market by far, solar energy. Just this past year in 2022, global demand increased just shy of 50%, and we see demand continuing to soar by a double-digit pace. So that number, that 320 gigawatts that you mentioned, that's on the order of 20% growth. 30% might even be achievable. So this is just a fast-growing business, and we don't see any end in sight. In the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act was passed last year that gives a big boost to the industry. We've got Repower EU over here in Europe, and solar is just a key component of the energy transition that we're seeing continue to unfold.
You know, one of the things we've learned, I guess, over the last year or so since the Ukraine war began is just how fragile the existing energy infrastructure is and supply demand on a global basis. Is solar enough to kind of make up for some of the disruption we're seeing in some of the fossil fuels?
By itself, absolutely not. But it is a very important part of the equation. I think last year you've rightfully pointed out that the world was very focused on energy security. And what we saw was amazing. During the 12-month feat, Europe essentially got itself off of Russian gas. Almost no one was saying that would be possible at the start of the crisis. Now, of course, we used less. We had a mild winter. Mm-hmm. We, of course, burned more coal. Nuclear is getting a second look. But in 2023, I think renewables are going to be a cornerstone of that plan to get off of fossil fuels in general, and mm-hmm. solar is going to be a big piece of it.
Okay, the other side of it is we think energy security and we think wind and solar. But I would say that you also have energy security issue with wind and solar because you have a lot of the guts and the parts that are made in areas like China. You need rare earth metals, the majority of that's in China. How does that factor into the ability for either these projects to have actual sustainable returns or for these projects to actually get done?
I love the question, and I think your mind's in the right place. And I think U.S. lawmakers were thinking about this when they passed the Inflation Reduction Act. Again, it's a terrible name. It should really be called the Energy Security Bill of 2022 or something like that. But the big component of the bill that maybe folks don't appreciate is the onshoring of U.S. manufacturing. So I think the U.S. wants to do a lot of wind, solar, hydrogen, all of these new things, but it wants to make sure that as much of the equipment is made in the United States as possible. Every day you're seeing new factories being announced in the U.S. for wind and solar equipment or batteries and all sorts of things like that. So I think the U.S. is very cognizant of those supply chain concerns because they don't want China to make all of the materials that help feed the energy transition. Now, Europe's a bit behind on this, and there's a lot of discussion over here right now about an IRA equivalent to help make sure that the Europeans also secure some of that supply chain with domestic manufacturing in Europe.
How do investors play this greening of the economy? What are kind of some of the major trends here, Rob, in terms of how to really invest in this?
Well, the great thing that's going on in both the wind and solar businesses is that we've seen a very marked easing of commodity prices that are relevant for those two businesses. So the key input for the solar business is this material called polysilicon. And since the start of December, prices have collapsed about 50%. Very stunning. We, in some ways, had been calling for a reversal in the price because we knew all of this new supply of the material was coming online. Mm-hmm. Well, we've started to see those new factories come online, and we're seeing the price respond. This is going to lower the input cost for making all those solar panels, so we see increased profitability for a number of players in the solar business this year. Just on the wind side, very similar set of conditions. Key input for the industry is steel prices. Mm-hmm. Now, steel prices have been edging up in recent weeks, but they're about 50% below highs touched last March. This is cost relief, which will help boost margins for the wind turbine manufacturers.
Quick thing. When are we going to be able to see it become a self-sustainable investment cycle?
Well, you know, the government support is relevant, but in many ways, the wind and solar business are sort of the mature cousins of the energy transition. If you want to put a solar electron or a wind electron on the grid, if you do a full cycle analysis, you're going to find that those are the cheapest items to put on the grid. Now, that being said, we know they're intermittent. They're not dispatchable. Solar plus storage, because of the run-up in fossil fuel prices, is cost-effective in many markets today.
All right, Rob, great stuff. Really appreciate it. Check it in with us. That's Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Energy Analyst Rob Barnett.
Let's stick with the energy sector and turn now to oil in particular, where tight oil rigs could actually enable land drillers like H&P and Nabors to boost EBITDA over 70% this year. So for more, we're joined now by Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industrials Analyst Scott Levine. Scott, what have we learned so far from the drillers and their earnings?
Yeah, I think what we've learned is that the activity in North America is likely to be even a bit slower than we anticipated. We do think there'll be growth, but we do think you could see some downside, particularly in gas drilling. Natural gas prices have pulled back below $3 per MMBTU. We can get into the reasons why, but the bottom line is that despite the fact that we're likely to see modest growth in activity, we're likely to see huge growth in earnings, and that's a function of very tight rig markets and huge increases in pricing, which in turn are going to drive large increases in earnings.
So when the prices were higher, I was going to grab Matt Miller's pickup truck, drive down to Texas, get some equipment, get some guys, and start drilling holes. Mm-hmm. They told me it's not as easy as that. And that comes back to what you guys talk about is these companies have had discipline.
Yeah.
Isn't it when you get, whether it's oil or natural gas, you get to a certain level and you're like, I got to drill because I can make a lot of money here.
Yeah, I guess the point really would be that $80 a barrel isn't really it.
Okay.
The truth of the matter is the group had a fantastic year last year, as did all of energy, right? Energy stocks in general up 60%. But if you look at the last 5 years, the group were miserable performers and lost the faith and trust of investors. And they're looking to win that back. They're looking to prove that 2022 is not just a trade and that these guys have discipline, are not going to pursue growth at all costs. And I think the outlook that we illustrate and that we see for this year is a reflection of that.
Okay, so based on that, something that I feel like for the U.S. guys, well, not even, you know, Schlumberger, Baker Hughes, is they're able to pass along some of these costs to the producers, right? I mean, mm-hmm. What is going to be the inflation pass-through and where does the squeeze happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say we're looking at volume growth at best of 10%, probably a little bit lower than even we expected a few months ago. But you've got very, very tight markets. So despite the fact that we're looking at upwards of 5 to 10% growth in costs for these drilling contractors and pressure pumping contractors as well, the tightness of the markets and their unwillingness to add additional capacity is what's going to drive the price and margin improvement. In reality, what we're really looking for this year is for the price gains that these companies realize to better reflect the leading edge pricing that we're seeing contracts going off in the marketplace for. It's really just churn of existing rigs going off contracts from a year or 2 years ago when markets weren't as tight, rolling over and repricing to much higher levels.
So can they find the labor to do all this right now? Because I know for so many industries, and I think including the industry, there was labor issues. Is that something they've been able to manage?
Yes, it is. It is something they're able to manage. They're going to have to pay a lot, obviously, to keep those crews happy. But this is a specialized business, right? You know,
and this isn't unionized, is it?
No, it is not. No, you know,
not
these
in Texas.
Guys. Yeah, it's a different world there, and it's a different world than it was even 3 years ago. And so, everybody knows how tight the markets are in general.
Yeah.
Everybody knows it's a good place to be. They're going to pay as much they have to keep the people happy, and there's enough folks to keep happy in order to keep the engines going and to see good growth in earnings and moderate growth, I would say, in activity levels.
So, Paul, to your point, if you go to the Permian,
yeah,
there's literally one road, I'm not kidding, one road that goes out to the oil fields. And that's it.
That's it.
And you have like all the trucks and all the people, and that's where like all the traffic is. Like that's how like bottlenecked this can also wind up being.
Right.
And you talk about food inflation?
Yep.
Try eating in the Permian, man. That is seriously expensive. All right, Scott, really appreciate it. Scott Levine, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industrials Analyst.
Coming up on the program, we'll get the latest from the equity market and what surprises it may hold this year.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. And this is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Earnings may be resilient in 2023, unlike recent recessions, but the lack of a major Fed reversal could keep returns in check. For more on that and what it means for equities this year, we're joined by Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams. So, Gina, I've seen peak inflation. I think I can see the light at the end of the tunnel for rate increases. We have earnings now. I guess they're going to be coming down, but it seems like we're kind of set for some kind of upward movement this year. Am I too bullish?
You know, Paul, I don't think you are necessarily too bullish. I do think we priced in a lot of risk with the downdraft that we saw in stocks in 2022. I think the upside is limited, but there is nonetheless upside in 2023 is the way that I would characterize our outlook. And that's because we think we've priced in most of the likely economic downdraft, but we're going to continue to struggle with that idea. And the recovery in 2024 is still very difficult to forecast and difficult to see into. That is compounded by the fact that we don't see the Fed doing their traditional extreme rate downdraft, which is usually very, very bullish for stocks. I don't think that's likely to happen in 2023. And the result of that is our outlook is kind of lackluster. But nonetheless, it is for some stability to start to emerge at the very least.
So here was my question this week, just as a random example. So saying that the bad news is priced in some extent, Sherwin-Williams, after they reported, was down 15%. I don't get it. Like, that's a housing play, right?
Yep.
It's a consumer housing play. So if we know that housing is rolling over, why wasn't that in the stock? And is that like a Sherwin-Williams specific thing, or is that in certain pockets we haven't priced it in?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I think a lot of it is honestly timing, Alex. If you look at the home builders across the board, you look at home builders as a leading industry, that group actually bottomed all the way back in June and has been rallying ever since June. And maybe in some cases you've got indexes like that or segments of the market that have rallied too far too fast on the hope that the worst of the worst was already priced, the Fed is going to be done. And so that does create some vulnerabilities inside the market. I would also suggest that that is the case for much of the tech sector, where, even though we saw such a huge downdraft in most tech stocks over the course of 2022, their valuations are still extremely high relative to the level of interest rates, which would imply to me that there's some anticipation in the investor base in the idea that tech is either going to create a big earnings rebound in 2023, which seems unlikely, or the Fed is going to reverse rates really quickly. So I think there are definitely pockets of vulnerability in the equity market. I would, you know, I would be foolish not to acknowledge that. And that's part of the reason why we're a little bit worried about, you know, the upside potential. We have, since we priced the worst case scenario in our mind back in September, we've rallied a lot in since September, October lows. And that does leave us somewhat vulnerable to a choppier period.
All right. I guess just in terms of earnings, we've only had about a third of the S&P 500 report so far. But looking at the EA function on the Bloomberg terminal, your research comes back to me because I'm looking at about 6% revenue growth, but basically flat to slightly lower earnings growth. That's the margin story you've been talking to us about for a long time. Where are we going to see the, you know, get to the other side of that margin contraction story?
Yeah. So margins, you know, I've been captivated by the margin story on the index for more than a year now. I remain captivated because there are so many different moving parts. We see the potential for operating margins. Company with the strongest operating margins do tend to outperform the S&P 500. And it appears that we're at a critical turning point where at least many ex-energy companies in the S&P 500 are anticipated to post their operating margin bottom within the first half of 2023 and rally into 2024. So you've got this really interesting potential inflection point on margins yet to occur. That said,
but before you move on, can I ask a question on that?
Yeah.
So if you see the inflection in margins in the back half of the year, for example, does that imply a stronger top line or does that imply inflation falling?
It implies inflation falling.
Okay.
And I think that so that this sort of leads into the next point. The area where you're not likely to see so much margin expansion is the area that was really strong in 2022, which is energy. And energy effectively, basically single-handedly held up S&P 500 operating margin last year. It's expected to weaken materially in 2023 on account of the commodity price downdraft, inflationary pressures really easing, which should allow for the rest of the index to move higher. But it's not one big story on margins yet. It still is a lot of margin volatility, and that friction can create a lot of turmoil in the S&P 500 price index at large.
All right, let's talk factors. During my entire career, I just did growth.
Okay.
Back in the day, we called GARP, growth at a reasonable price, and that's the
whole
reason.
That guy.
The only reason you went to Denver is because that was the GARP capital of the world. Janus, Invesco, founders, all those guys. But value has kind of been a play. I mean, all those people you would never talk to in the schoolyard because they were value investors, now they're doing well.
Yes. And we anticipate value will continue to do well this year. Our quant strategist, Chris Kane, actually runs a tactical factor scorecard, and it has been magnificent. It has ranked value at the top of the scorecard and ranking number one or two among all BI factors for roughly 2 years now. Value's been a huge winner. Intriguingly, a lot of the reason that value was a winner was not because people were buying value stocks en masse. It was more because people were selling off the anti-value stocks, or the contra factor, which you might label as growth.
Yep.
I've been prohibited from labeling those as growth by my quant strategist, but nonetheless. So I think that there's an opportunity actually for the long end of value to do quite well. And you see some potential strength emerging in those true value stocks as a real possibility at inflection points in the cycle, at points when we start to price that recovery into 2024.
So this actually goes back to your energy point, because energy is slash was value. But if energy margins are going to be one of the first to get hit, especially because of tough comps, is energy still value? Like, what? Where are they in this?
So this is the magic of factors. Factors are sector neutralized. So the energy, there's no sector exposure in factor investing if you're doing it on a sector neutralized basis. Certainly, energy is a component of value, and there are plenty of value stocks still in the energy space, less than there were a year or two ago. But nonetheless, on a sector neutralized basis, you're not really exposed to the sector call because it is a sector neutralized idea. It really is a matter of selecting the cheapest stocks in the index, going long those, and going short the most expensive stocks on a valuation metric.
Matt Miller and I had a guest on in the last couple of weeks, and it just what they're mentioned to me just stuck in my head, maybe because it's very simple, that this is going to be the decade of the dividend.
Okay.
What do you think about dividends? Like, I like dividends. I like the clipping coupons.
Yeah. It's a difficult concept as a U.S. equity strategist to really embrace dividends. Right. However, my European team, my European equity strategists love dividends, have loved dividends forever, and follow them very closely. Logic would dictate that in an environment in which inflation pressures remain somewhat dominant or somewhat higher than what we've been used to, and interest rates remain relatively high, the value of dividends does go higher. So higher yielding stocks with dividend growth could ultimately be a pretty reasonable place to put some capital in an environment where, if you believe that inflation and interest rates are going to remain higher for longer, that factor could start to work pretty well.
See.
To wrap it up, earnings recession, we in it?
Oh, yes. We've been in an earnings recession. This is one of my bones to pick with the narrative out there, is we all so deeply focus on whether or not we're in or not in an economic recession. But in reality, the earnings stream has been in recession since it peaked a year ago. It peaked at the end of 2021, and on an unadjusted basis has fallen about 7%, is expected to continue to fall over the course of the next couple of quarters. So we are in some form of an earnings recession. And frankly, earnings are what drive stock prices. So we'll continue to argue about the economy, and I'll continue to point out that the only thing that really matters is earnings.
Says the equity strategist.
Exactly,
yeah,
right.
Of course.
Talking up the book. All right, thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams.
All right, coming up on the program, we're going to see what's in store for U.S. Treasuries this year.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Let's shift our focus now to the Fed. The economy slowing, inflation slowing, but remains a concern. 10-year treasuries, though, are still on track for 2.68% by the end of 2023. Joining us now, Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist Ira Jersey from Bloomberg Intelligence. Really? 2.68%?
Yeah, I some people are saying it's a pretty bold call. When we first made this call last October, people were really, thought it was an insane call. But at the same time, if we think that the economy is going to be slowing significantly, the Federal Reserve is going to be cutting interest rates quite a lot in 2024, then the market's going to price for that. And the way that initially occurs is you see a rally throughout the Treasury yield curve. And so the 10-year yield being below 3% is, I think, a very high probability by the end of this year. Hmm.
So, Ira, we've got a lot of economic data this past week. You know, how do you think our Federal Reserve is kind of parsing all this together? Because we will hear from the Fed next week.
Yeah, so, the data's been reasonably mixed. I think it's interesting that some of the GDP data in particular outperformed what the market was expecting. So clearly, the economy might be on somewhat better footing as we head into the year. But you look at some other data from previous in the month, things like retail sales slipped a little bit, and that trend is not particularly good at the moment. So the data is very, very mixed. But I think that the big thing that the Federal Reserve is going to tell us, Paul, is that they're nearing the end of their hikes. They've done a lot already, and they need to take a wait-and-see approach, at least for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that that's a lot what you'll hear from Jay Powell during the press conference.
So that's going to feel like a Bank of Canada kind of situation. If the market, though, reacts in kind, which is you're going to go and buy treasuries, you're going to go ahead and sell the dollar, I don't know what you're going to do with equities, like, doesn't that defeat the purpose for the Fed, just going to loosen financial conditions?
Well, it will loosen financial conditions, but at the same time, I think the Fed is kind of stuck in a way, because if they hike too much, mm-hmm. then financial conditions might tighten even further. You know, interestingly, when we talk about financial conditions, the one thing that most financial conditions indices don't have, which is something also that the Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index doesn't have, is actually the level of rates, right? So there certainly has been an effect with the very significant move higher in interest rates over the past year and a half, where you see a significant slowing in the housing market. You see in some other sectors, like some big ticket items aren't being bought on credit. Loan growth is relatively high, which is interesting in some sectors, but it's also not necessarily across every sector. So I think the level of rates has something to do with it too. And secondly, keep in mind that in the next couple of months, if the core PCE deflator continues to trend a bit lower than it was certainly in the middle of last year, we're going to have the Fed's key measure of inflation be at or below the level of interest rates. So if the Fed hikes to 5.25% and we have year-on-year inflation running about 5%, maybe a little bit under, that's a scenario that the Fed can live with. And I think that they'll tell you, and Jay Powell will probably hint at this, is that they're in restrictive territory. They have positive real yields, and their belief is that that will eventually slow inflation in the economy.
So, Ira, oftentimes when we speak to, you know, experts in the market like yourself, we hear that markets are pricing in rate cuts maybe late this year, early 24, but that's not consistent at all with the rhetoric we hear from most of the members of the Federal Reserve. Is that typical? How should we think about that?
Yeah, the market believes that and this is one of the reasons why I think financial conditions have eased quite a lot, is because the market continues to think that the Fed is going to be cutting interest rates later this year. Mm-hmm. And the challenge for Jay Powell next week is going to be how to walk the tightrope that we're going to be stopping, but we're also not cutting for ages and ages, right, into 2024. It's going to be hard for him to be that explicit, but I think he almost has to be. I think to convince the market that the Fed's not going to be cutting before year end. He's just going to have to say it. Just say, okay, here's the conditions where we would be cutting. Here's the conditions where we're definitely not cutting. And if he's able to articulate that and say something, for example, my view is that as long as there's not job losses, the Fed will keep interest rates at the peak for longer than the market's currently thinking. So I think that's the single biggest thing that the market's getting wrong, and that can have ramifications across a lot of risk asset markets, and that could tighten financial conditions. Like, the Fed doesn't have to keep hiking to tighten financial conditions. The Fed just has to convince the market that, hey, we're keeping interest rates at 5% till the middle of 2024. And if the market believes that, you're going to see a whole repricing of the front end of the curve, and you're probably going to see risk assets, you're going to see credit spreads a little wider, equities a little lower, and that will tighten financial conditions.
So basically, the Fed has to convince the market that it's going to stay at the terminal rate for a long time. So if that's what it needs to do, and you're looking at that 2.68% by the end of 2023, what economy does all of that echo, and how long a time the Fed at terminal does that imply?
So our view is that we might hit a little bit a technical recession, but it's going to be a recession that's going to be inventory driven, and that's something that Anna Wong, our colleagues over at Bloomberg Economics, believe. And in inventory recessions, and we've only had one of those in the last 50 years or so, but those types of recessions typically don't see particularly large job losses. And because of that, I think we can have an environment where we have a shallow recession. We don't have significant or any job losses necessarily, but we do see wages not increasing at the same pace they did over the last 12 or 18 months. And in a scenario like that, the Fed can stay on hold until 2024, 2025, well, maybe not 25, but sometime into 2024, when you wind up seeing some maybe job losses because, you know, people are retooling and rethinking their staffing and the like. But the job market's so strong right now, it's hard to see how we have meaningful job losses that wind up creating a recessionary type of environment.
I don't know about you, Ira, but I think the Federal Reserve's done a pretty good job. And that whole behind the curve thing, I'm not sure. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think the market's telling us?
Well, I think the Fed did a bad job early in that, and quite frankly, a lot of us didn't do a great job in that they didn't really anticipate that inflation was quite as significant as it was. You know, we had been saying in late 2021 that the Federal Reserve at that point should have started to run off their balance sheet and started to tighten monetary policy kind of in a modest way, but they didn't. But I think that they caught up reasonably quickly. Was it fast enough? I think you could give them more of a grade of a B or B minus. I don't think it was perfect, but I think they did a reasonably good job given the scenario that they put themselves into.
Ira, really appreciate it. Always good to talk to you. Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist. Now let's turn to banks. You got fixed income, currency, commodities trading revenue may rise about 20% from a year earlier. For more on that and what it means for names like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, let's welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Banks Analyst Allison Williams. Allison, put that in context for us. If you get fixed trading revenue up 20%, what's the time frame I'm looking at for that?
So that really is referring to the good growth that we saw in the fourth quarter. We haven't gotten all the numbers in yet, but based on the U.S. Reports, the numbers were very strong, and it was a really good year for fixed income trading in 2022, but we think that what could be surprising is relative resilience this year, and that's just because if you look at interest rates, we think that there will continue to be a high level of uncertainty, but we just think that given the trillions of dollars on the Fed's balance sheet, to the ECB's balance sheet, central banks around the world, and what's happening with inflation, the economic worries, that the sort of unprecedented unwind of the quantitative easing that we've seen over the last several years and the macroeconomic worries is going to fuel uncertainty, and that's going to fuel trading.
How do I break it down between investment grade, high yield, converts, all those types of things? Are we going to see strength across all those areas, or are there certain areas that are going to really drive the growth?
So the areas that we think will still be strong relate really to interest rate and currencies. Some of the areas that you're talking about, Paul, in terms of investment grade and high grade, we also do think that there could be a recovery in those areas in terms of the trading desks this year. Last year, we saw some pain in that category, and that really related to the fact that we saw a very limited calendar in terms of new issuance coming to market. We also had credit spreads widening significantly. There was better performance at the end of the year, but significant widening, especially through the first half. And that really put a damper on credit trading. And so that area we think could normalize a little bit. This year, commodities is the other area that was super strong last year in terms of trading. And we think that there's a little bit of momentum coming into this year.
Let's take that view and turn it to the European banks. So the European banks are going to start at the end of next week, or this coming week, I should say. What did we learn from the U.S. guys, and then how do we read through on that to the Europeans?
In general, the revenue trends that we saw from the U.S. competitors were essentially in line. FICC trading, we expected to be strong. It came in a little bit better than expected. Equity trading, we expected to be a little weaker. That also came in as expected, perhaps a little weaker. And then fees cut in half, similar to the expectation. So looking to the Europeans next week, Deutsche Bank is really the bank that benefits the most from fixed income trading across their Europeans and across global banks, just because even though they've downsized their investment bank as a whole, a lot of the cuts were to equities trading. And so fixed income trading is significantly important for them. And we expect that they're going to have good results next week, continuing to show, you know, that they've sort of steadied the ship there in terms of market share. On UBS, their business is less skewed to FICC, but they've had really good cost control. We think that's going to help their profitability. And the one thing that we are going to be focusing on is the cost side of things, especially compensation. Mm-hmm. What we heard from the U.S. banks, and especially at companies like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, is that the competitive environment has not come in as much as would have been expected. We talked about those the significant decline in investment banking fees, but we're not going to see bonuses decline, I think, to the same extent that we saw the fees decline, because investment banks are still holding out a little bit of that hope. So from the Europeans, we're going to want to see what they're doing in terms of compensation and try to get a better sense of the global picture there.
Way, way, way back in the day at the Chase Manhattan Bank, before it was JP Morgan Chase, I spent a rotation on the currency FX trading desk, and I was just stunned.
Did you really?
And I was just stunned at the total gajillions of dollars that are traded every day in that market. It just blew me away. So, Allison, talk to us about the currency business. Do the banks make money on that? Is it a consistent business? Do they all play as aggressively together?
It's been a pretty strong year for currencies, and I think, you know, along with the rates business, we could see some opportunity there in 2023. Again, some of the benefit there is really just to the extent that we see divergence in monetary policies. And you talked about being impressed by the trillions of dollars that move through those desks. Those desks still do see a significant amount of volumes. That's also a business, you know, we talked about Deutsche Bank before. That's a business that they've stayed significantly strong in. It's also a business that UBS and Barclays are relatively strong in. And so, especially with UBS coming up this week, we're going to see if that can help their numbers a little bit. Fixed income trading overall is on the smaller side for UBS, but that currency vertical is an area where they've showed continued strength.
So aside from trading and investment banking, which was just terrible, a couple questions on that. Like, when is that trough? And next week, who's going to be the worst off?
So I think the worst off is going to be the week after, which is Credit Suisse. And that's just because
let's put that aside for a second. Aside from Credit Suisse.
Okay. So aside from Credit Suisse, so it depends. It's all relative, right? Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of the revenue trend, Deutsche is getting that lift from fixed income. But in terms of overall returns, and that's what investors really focus on, UBS really showing resilience in terms of when we look at their returns this year compared to last year, relatively stable and significantly better than Deutsche Bank.
All right, Allison, thank you very much. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Banks Analyst, Allison Williams.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. Stay with us. Today's top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation, and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA, and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global, and Schneider Electric. Visit bloomberglive.com/sbs2024 to learn more.